The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a slightly new format for the Edition podcast. We're going to be talking about the magazine, as per usual, but we're going to try to give a little bit more insight into the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm not Lara Prendergast, I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor. Sorry. So, Will, we're talking on Thursday afternoon. The magazine went to press a little bit later, actually, this week, yesterday, for the budget. Our cover this week is Freddie Gray on what to expect from Trump's second term. Can you take us back to conference on Monday, our editorial conference, and just explain to listeners why we came up with that idea?
Well, obviously, this Tuesday just gone was Super Tuesday, and I think we've known for a long time, everyone's known for a long time, that Trump was almost certainly going to win big on Tuesday. And that's, of course, what happened. And Nikki Haley dropped out of the race. And given that it looks like Trump is almost certainly going to go up against Biden now at the end of the year and pretty likely to win, it's about time to ask, what might that look like? And Freddie has written an extremely good cover piece in which he focuses on the theme of revenge, which he says runs through the whole of Trump's re-election campaign. And then in conference, Katie Balls, our politics editor, came up with a very good idea of asking our brilliant cover artist, Morten Moreland, to do the cover as a pastiche of that famous Obama Hope poster by the artist. What's the name of the artist?
Shepard Fairey, I think.
Is it? Okay. Well, that very famous, I mean, every listener will know it, the really famous Obama Hope poster, done with Trump's mugshot, but with the word revenge instead of hope. And I think it's extremely good, bold, striking image.
I mean, one of the things I quite liked about this week's edition is that I think about an hour before press, all our phones kind of pinged and we saw that Nikki Haley had dropped out.
Yes.
And we've got Kate Andrews' excellent piece on why the Never Trump movement failed. Kate's going to talk to us in a minute. But I always enjoy those moments when, I mean, you know, obviously Super Tuesday is a set piece.
Yeah.
But when we're, you know, able to look ahead a little bit and intuit, you know, the kind of things that are going to happen in the week so that we can give you, our readers and listeners, something fresh and interesting to
read.
Yes,
completely agree. And we're very grateful, therefore, for Nikki for dropping out when
she
did, because
yeah, exactly.
It was perfect timing for us. And we were joined earlier by Freddie Gray, our deputy editor, and Kate Andrews, our economics editor, to talk about their two pieces which they wrote on Trump's second coming. So here's what they had to say. Freddie, you write your cover piece this week about Trump. Trump is back, and he's back with a vengeance. Can you start by explaining to our listeners why retribution is a theme of his campaign?
Well, Donald Trump has written quite a few books. He hasn't written them, of course. He sort of narrated them to someone, if he did that. But he did have quite an interesting book in 2007. Everybody knows about Art of the Deal. But he had a book in 2007 that was called Think Big and Kick Ass in Business and Life. And he has a whole chapter on retribution. And taking into account it probably wasn't Donald Trump's original work, but it sort of reflects his personality and he would have authorized it. It gives you an insight into how he thinks about things. And the key quote from it is, my motto is always get even. If somebody screws you, screw them back in spades. And there's a few other sentiments like that. And it speaks very much to Trump's mindset, which is very informed by sort of wrestling and this idea that, you know, if you get hit, you hit back much harder. And his great humiliation, of course, was 2020. He lost. The world saw him lose. And there is absolutely no doubt he's been brooding about it for a long time. And I think now he's starting to see an opportunity for revenge presenting itself on a plate. And it's an extraordinary comeback story.
Revenge against Biden or revenge against the American deep state?
The deep state, deep state, obviously. Right. What I think is interesting is quite a lot of Americans share his sense of a need for retribution, and not just Trump fans. Independents do not like the legal persecution of Donald Trump. They see that it's obviously political, because it obviously is. And they think it deserves some sort of punishment in itself. And I think that's why you're seeing this swing towards Trump in the polls, which you've seen in recent months. In fact, it correlates quite neatly with the start of the legal persecution against him.
Kate, you're an American. Do you have this feeling, this desire for vengeance?
I wouldn't say that anyone has the same desire for vengeance as perhaps Donald Trump does. As somebody who kind of associated with Never Trumpism very early on, long before he became the candidate in 2016, that was just kind of a gut instinct rather than the actual movement that it's come to be known as. I think you could always sense that angriness in Donald Trump, that vindictiveness, but I think that this is 2.0, perhaps 5.0. I think it's so much worse. And I think a lot of Americans are going to come to see that. But where I completely agree is Americans don't like to be told who to vote for. They don't like to be told that they can't vote for somebody. They don't like having them taken off the ballot. They don't like the idea of political opponents being thrown in jail. Donald Trump is doing very well out of saying, you know, they're after me, so I'm going to go after them. It feeds into this idea that Americans are being hard done by, something he did very well out of in 2016. But, you know, I'm filled with dread because I look at some of the words that he uses, including retribution, talking about setting up a special prosecutor to go after Joe Biden and his family. And I would like all of this to come to an end. I would like us to stop trying to put our political opponents in jail, whether they're on the right or the left. I think someone like Donald Trump is only going to ramp that up.
Freddie, all this talk then of vengeance, retribution, is it all just bluster? I mean, Trump is known for, I mean, we all remember Lock Her Up in 2016. He didn't actually go after Hillary Clinton in any kind of legal sense once he was in office. So could this all just be the same again?
I think a lot of it is bluster. I do think that he will try to do something about the Department of Justice. I think he will fire as many people as he can within a lot of administrative agencies. I think that he's serious about that. I think the people around him are even more serious about that. But at the same time, you've got to remember it's Donald Trump. So everything is sort of serious and a joke at the same time. And the most pertinent line he said about this so far in this election campaign is when he was asked by Sean Hannity on Fox about, you know, are you going to be a dictator? He said, I'll only be a dictator on day one. And on day one, we're going to close the border and we're going to drill, drill, drill. And that's obviously talking about drilling for oil and gas. And, of course, immigration, which he's also very serious about. And so what he's talking about there is he's going to do executive orders, which every new president does. And you hear a lot of hysterical talk about dictatorship in America. And a lot of it really is concern about the imperial power of the presidency, which is a much bigger story than Donald Trump. It's just something that's happened since the Second World War, is that the American presidency has outgrown what the founders intended it to be, and it is now a regal position.
Fred, you mentioned there the people around Trump wanting to fire a lot of people in government. You also say in the piece that there are discussions about Christian nationalism. Mm. Could you just explain to us quickly what that is?
Well, it's a very good question. What is Christian nationalism? Because if you read the New York Times, I think you think if you're Christian and patriotic, then you're a Christian nationalist. I mean, there is certainly Trumpism is a nationalist movement in many ways, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's fascist. And it has a strong Christian element. White evangelicals love Donald Trump. They're voting up to 95% of white evangelicals in some states are voting for Donald Trump. And there is, again, this ties into the retribution talk. It's a kind of biblical sense that he is some, and I think, you know, you can get carried away with this stuff, but I think the kind of spiritual appeal of Donald Trump is underestimated. For a lot of Americans, it feels like just that he's going to win.
Kate, you wrote a piece for the magazine this week, which ran alongside Freddie's, in which, as a Never Trump Republican, you wrote about the failure of the Never Trump movement. Now that Nikki Haley has dropped out of the race, there is no one left in the Republican Party opposing Trump's path to the nomination. Why did the Never Trump movement fail? Was it always inevitable that it would fail?
I don't know if it was inevitable, but I'm not surprised that it did. I think as many good organic movements do, it turns into something a lot more technical and a lot more ugly that actually ends up turning in on itself. And I think that's exactly what happened. The Never Trump movement started to turn on Republicans. It started out as this very organic process in which former Republican presidents and former Republican presidential candidates and really serious people within the Republican Party were saying that what Donald Trump was bringing to the table simply wasn't good enough for Republican voters, that it was the antithesis, really, of so many of those core Republican values. values and commitment to liberty. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have projects like the Lincoln Project, you know, not taking very long to start saying things like Republican voters are identical to the most extreme MAGA politicians, demonizing the core voters that they were in theory trying to help in the first place. I also think that Never Trumpism melded with this idea of anyone but Trump. And those are two very different things. So, I mean, I'm a Never Trumper, but that doesn't mean that I think that anybody besides Donald Trump would necessarily be better. We've found ourselves in a very weird situation in this Republican primary process where truly awful candidates were being held up as Republican saviors because they weren't Donald Trump. Ron DeSantis was never properly scrutinized. The governor of Florida got a free pass because of how he handled COVID. But I think many of his authoritarian streaks, the fact that he's just simply not a very good communicator, was never scrutinized, and people held him up like he's going to be the great savior of the Republican Party. You had people like Vivek Ramaswamy, who I find in many ways equally, if not more frightening than Donald Trump, especially when it comes to foreign policy. Foreign policy is one of the few areas where I really do like a lot of what Donald Trump did. And you've got Ramaswamy saying, actually, we'll give Taiwan to China, let China seize Taiwan when we have enough microchips. So there just wasn't proper scrutiny of the candidates. I have to believe in a country of 360 million people that maybe somebody could have been a better Republican contender than the people we had on stage, or indeed Donald Trump. They were not found this time around.
As Will just said, Nikki Haley dropped out this week. Can you articulate her kind of vision for what the Republican Party would have looked like and what America would have looked like under her presidency?
I think she's an easier one to articulate, and perhaps one of the reasons that she did best, despite not doing very well, is because she was a bit of a throwback to that early noughties Republican idea of being a bit firmer on foreign policy, certainly promoting low tax, having a softer touch to a lot of those conservative values that I think Donald Trump takes a slightly harder edge to. And I think some people responded well to that. I think she was the most consistent, and I think she appealed to a lot of that old guard. But there are a lot of Republican voters now who don't want to return to the Bush-Cheney era of bombing and not always knowing where you're bombing or what you're bombing, as was revealed on stage at one point. She did manage to name provinces in eastern Ukraine, but she struggled to do so immediately when asked, when she was talking about more U.S. military intervention in those areas. And I just think it made a lot of Republican voters uneasy because we have shifted into a totally different era where both Republicans and Democrats want a lot more justification if America is going to be doing things abroad. It's not to say that they're opposed to intervention, especially if it doesn't involve boots on the ground, but they are going to demand better answers given all of the horrors that we saw in Iraq.
Freddie, you say in your piece that what makes Trump's presidential bid different this time is that this time he's the favorite. So if he does secure a second term in the White House, what else could we expect from this term? You've already mentioned immigration and drilling as two priorities, but are there other things we should anticipate? And who might be on his top team this time around?
Well, just to start on the favourite thing, I do think that's quite interesting. And I think he looked quite subdued on Tuesday, Super Tuesday. And I don't think he likes it when everything seems to be falling in place. He's always said, I like things nice and complicated. He thinks very much in terms of narrative media cycles. And for him, this has been such a good week for him, you know, wrapping up the nomination, the Supreme Court ruling in his favor, crucially, on Monday. He knows that there's a counter-narrative coming. Joe Biden's going to give a speech today, State of the Union address. He's going to go after Donald Trump. And the Democratic media, you can sense, they're gearing up to say, you know, he's Biden's back. He's, you know, don't underestimate him, et cetera, et cetera. So I think Trump wants to keep things dicey. That's why he often throws in the nastiest insults, the most vicious insults, when he's doing well, to keep people guessing, to keep causing shock value and so on, because he wants to have a late charge for the presidency. When Trump is actually at his best as a candidate, and I mean best as in most effective, is in the last 3 weeks of every election campaign, or both presidential election campaigns he's fought. He, as a Republican nominee, he is quite brilliant. He goes into this sort of overdrive of charm. He's funny. He's light. He drops all the nastiness. And that's his art. That's his great marketing genius, I think, is that people go, oh, he's not that horrible. He's quite funny. He's quite likable. And it's shocking to people, and they warm to him.
And then what about a second term? What else
second
can
term,
we...
Sorry, yeah, that was your main question. I think, it'll be much more of the same. Donald Trump is a creature of habit, as Michael Wolff put it yesterday on another Spectator broadcast. He will go for the border in a big way. He will deport undocumented migrants. I think they're very serious about doing that. So reviving Eisenhower's Operation Wetback program. He will drill. He's very serious about that. He talks a lot about the electrification of the grid. And I think, actually, people who want to know what Donald Trump's second term will look like should look at the series of videos he produced last year called the Agenda 47 videos. And he just does these, you know, typically weird but very clear statements about what he's going to do.
I think Freddie also just summed up quite nicely another reason that the Never Trump movement failed, because he's actually quite clear about a lot of his policy agenda. He's pretty transparent about that. He's also excellent at throwing in words and curveballs, for example, calling his political opponents vermin.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he does that on one side. It's gross. It's an awful thing to say. But then
I thought birdface for Nikki Haley was particularly inventive.
Some of those names are incredibly inventive. Then on the other side, you then get 3,000-word think pieces about why it's a problem that Donald Trump calls his political opponents vermin and why this really matters. And what you don't get is a scrutiny of a baseline of universal tariffs and all the rest of it, things that make Americans poorer. Because nobody actually wants to engage with policy ideas. And so the biggest character, the biggest showman, obviously rises to the top quite quickly, actually.
Kate and Freddie, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you. Gus, what other pieces did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
I always love Tanya's restaurant reviews. I think she's just such a brilliant, kind of funny writer. And she has kind of a very strange way of constructing sentences that I think you could just pull it out of the copy and put it in front of me and I'd know, like, that's a Tanya sentence. And yeah, I just think she's fantastic. I also thought Michael Hand's review of Gunn, a band that I hadn't heard of, was great. I thought the intro was just kind of really well constructed.
I completely agree. As someone who's not interested in rock kind of at all, I still always enjoy reading him, which I think is a fantastic
Totally.
Song.
And actually, I'd like to remind listeners that Rod Liddell also writes a pop column occasionally, and he has in this week's edition. It's called The Listener, and you'll find it on page 47. Mm. What did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
There's a book review that I love by Frank Lawton, and he's reviewing a book by Catherine Nixie called Heresy, Jesus Christ and the Other Sons of God. And it's got just a fantastic opening sentence, which is, what people tend to forget about Jesus Christ is that he killed children, which I think means, I mean, you just got to read on after that. And what it's about is a lot of the apocryphal gospel stories of Jesus in his infancy, some of which are really funky, yeah, and you can see why they were cut from the Bible. And that's just a fantastic book review. I would also like to draw attention to our guest life columnist. For all of this year, we've been running guest life columns from various writers who we want to hear from. And this one is from Cosmo Landsman, City Life, and he writes an extremely funny column about how he realized that after years of believing he was a bohemian, he may not be as bohemian as he thought. And here's an extract from his excellent column, read by Cosmo.
I was freaking out even before the drugs took effect. Then the voice of my young bohemian self said, "For heaven's sakes, relax. Can't you just let your hair down and have a little fun for once, you old square? You've become so uptight and boring. Go wild. You're such a puritanical wuss. Do you think Keith Richard goes, 'Oh, dear me, I've done a gummy. Mick, help me, please.' Cosmo, what harm can one little gummy do?" I found out about 40 minutes later when a friend who had also eaten one passed out and fell to the floor, head first. She was unconscious for a few minutes. I discovered another gummy guy sitting on his own in a dark room, staring intensely at his feet, quivering with paranoia. By now, the stone hostess had gone to bed, unable to string a coherent sentence together. And me, I felt as if I was about to pass out too. Someone later told me I ran out of the party yelling, "Help, I'm going to die." I had a very druggy adolescence. My parents were old bohemians. For Christmas, they regularly gave my brother and me a lump of hashish, cigarette papers, and a packet of fags. As a family, we get stoned and watch the Christmas edition of the Top of the Pops. And even though I quit taking drugs decades ago, they've always been part of the world I've moved in and identified with. Artists, writers, poets, musicians, and crazies, these are my people. or at least they used to be.
The second feature we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail is Flora Watkins' piece on private schools. She wrote about why she's taking her children out of private school, partly because of a rise in school fees brought on by inflation and the cost of living, but also partly in anticipation of Labour imposing VAT on school fees. So to talk about her piece, we spoke to Julie Robinson, the General Secretary of the Independent Schools Council, and Fiona Miller, former education advisor under Tony Blair. Julie, in the magazine this week, Flora Watkins writes about why she's taken her children out of private school. I wonder, is her story similar to the stories of other parents that the ISC represents?
I mean, it's too soon to see genuine trends, but we are hearing from heads that there is absolutely an anxiety amongst parents. There's concern, and prospective parents are asking heads what's going to happen. So it's a very difficult time for them.
Fiona, do you have much sympathy for parents that are worried about the end of the tax exemption around private schools?
Well, obviously, I've got sympathy for any parent's concern when it comes to their children's education. But on the whole, I think it's better to look at these policy issues in the round and in terms of the entire school population rather than one small group of parents. The fact is there are 8 million children in state schools and 500,000 in private schools. And in this dire situation we're in, it seems to me that recouping some of the money that's effectively subsidising the private sector at the moment to invest in the state sector is the fair and just thing to do. So I prefer to think about it in that sense rather than just focus on the small number of parents whose children are in private schools.
Well, I mean, parents of children in private schools would say that actually they're the ones subsidising state education. They're paying twice, once through their taxes and then again through fees.
Well, I think you could argue with almost any form of public service that people can choose to add on to what they might otherwise get. This is a personal choice. I don't see it like that. But we have to look at the facts here. The average funding for a state pupil is around £6,000 per head. Hasn't really shifted much in the last 10 years. Whereas the private school fees have continued to rise incrementally, and the gap is now about £10,000 plus per pupil. That just simply cannot be right in a country that wants to promote social justice and, as this government still claims it does, to level up. Therefore, something's going to have to happen. And if it means removing the tax exemptions for private schools so that more money can go into state schools and the system to state parents feels fairer, which I think the polling suggests that most of the people think this is fair, then I think that's probably one of the first things that we should be doing. But I don't pretend at all that it's going to solve all the problems in the state sector, which are considerable at the moment. But it needs to be seen as part of a whole policy for the whole country, not just for one small group of parents.
Julie, I would love to know your thoughts on Fiona's point there about fairness, and that polls show that actually people do consider imposing VAT on school fees to be a fair move.
Yeah, I completely agree with Fiona about looking at the entire school population, and that state schooling is very much underfunded at the moment and needs to increase. Unfortunately, if you put VAT at 20% on school fees, and that's a tax on parents, that's not removing a tax break, that's an additional tax that doesn't really exist across the globe, and certainly not in Europe. So if you put that extra tax onto the parents to try to gain more money to put into state education, actually, the net effect is going to be damage to the state system. But I think that money needs to come from elsewhere, not from another part of education. Because as parents, like the one you've cited, like as those parents are feeling squeezed out, it will displace children into the state system. We've got over 100,000 special needs children who could potentially be displaced into the state system. It's already so stretched. We wouldn't want to put more pressure on the state system in accommodating those pupils. So this policy won't achieve what is stated, in fact. If we want to do the best we can for the 93%, for the whole child population for education, we need to be working together, we need to be sharing facilities, we need to be sharing expertise and doing what we can together across the system.
Fiona, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, the point is there's going to be a million extra state school places in the next 10 years. That's well documented. That's the government's own figure. So we're currently funding a million places that may not be filled in the next 10 years. So there is plenty of space in the state sector at the current levels of funding to take in the much smaller number of children that might come in from the private sector. And I would say that we want those children in. We don't have, you know, the worry is that you end up with these very fragmented public services that only educate or treat for health one small sliver of the population. That's where we could be headed with this if we don't try and equalise the situation. So the wealthy parents send their children to private schools. The less well-off children are sort of segregated in the state sector. We want to have schools that are fully inclusive of all members of the society. So from my point of view, it's not even really about the money. It's about having a properly inclusive, comprehensive system finally in this country, not one in which people who have more money can buy a competitive advantage for their children. And incidentally, I mean, I think we've got to watch against sounding as though you're sending your children to the front in the First World War when you put them into a state school. I mean, the thing about this piece is the woman seems quite happy with her education in the state sector. The majority of parents whose kids are educated in state schools are happy, and I'm one of them. You know, you can get an extremely good education in a state school, but the fact is you're not going to get all the extra bells and whistles you get in the private sector unless you fund state schools at the same level as private schools. So any way that we can redress the balance, equalise the funding across the state and private sector has got to be a good thing.
But Fiona, sorry, on the point about competitive advantage, though, don't you think there's a risk, which Flora sort of touches on in her piece, that if the hardworking middle class are essentially squeezed out of private education because of any increase to costs, then what will become of private schools then? Won't it just become even more an insular club, you know, even more just a place for a very small percentage of the elite?
Possibly, but I think having those aspirant middle class parents back in the state sector would far outweigh the risks of the private sector withering on the vine and becoming a refuge from sort of wealthy Russians and Chinese and people in the Gulf state, which is what's happening in a lot of areas. So, you know, I think to try to see the system as a whole, we know that the best performing school systems in the world do not segregate children into different types of school, especially at 11. They keep children in the same schools and they invest heavily in teaching and, you know, have good, strong local systems of accountability. And that's the best way to narrow gaps. People go on about the success story of the education system in this country. It's an absolute scandal that the gap between the best and the worst off children is actually widening now, partly because of COVID. But that cannot be right, that the poorest children get the least in society and the wealthiest children get the most. Look at it globally for the whole of England, really, because education devolved. We've got to look at ways of equalising, and this is one small way that that can happen.
I think the independent sector across the UK is far, far more diverse than many people realise. We're actually educating more Ukrainian pupils than Russian pupils this year, and the proportion of children whose parents live overseas is 5%, and it's been steady at 5% for 50 years. So there are plenty of aspirant middle classes in independent schools. The typical fee-paying parent, they pay their fees from taxes. It's a dual-income family. And we know from Sutton Trust research that inequality is greater across the state system than the difference between the top independent schools and the state. There are some fantastic state schools, but also Sutton Trust shows us that where there's greater competition for the best state schools, it's disadvantaged children who miss out. And we all want more of those children to get places in the very, very best state schools. So Fiona mentions that there are spaces in the state sector. Yes, there are, but there's pressure on the best school places. So in somewhere like Camden, there are places available in state schools, but the most popular schools are oversubscribed. And even taking into account a changing birth rate, there is a lot of pressure on those good state schools, and we've been to get the very, very best education.
Julie, is it not the case that private schools could actually choose to reduce their fees in order to offset the cost of VAT if they wanted to? You know, private school fees have gone up astronomically in the last 20 years. This is really something that the industry itself could choose to accommodate if it wanted to.
I know schools have started looking at how they can plan ahead. But you need to remember that schools, just like everyone else, they're suffering from inflationary pressures. There's a lot of uncertainty out there financially. Parents, too, are under pressure from mortgages and cost of living. So this is not an easy time to try to make savings.
So the expectation that normal independent schools, typical independent schools, can cut their costs by a fifth is really quite something, because they've got increasing inflationary costs anyway, utilities and everything else. They've actually got to cover, I mean, the main outgoing for a school is staffing. So these are schools who want to pay their staff properly. And in delivering terms and conditions, when they're looking at the pension, independent schools now who have to pay the employer contribution, that contribution is going up to over 28% this April. So there are a lot of cost pressures on independent schools. Yes, I know they are looking at how they would handle a sudden increase for their parents of 20%. But let's just remember, this isn't a tax on the schools, it's a tax on the parents. This is VAT on education, even though education is tax exempt pretty much across the world.
So, Gus, this is actually something a little bit embarrassing, because I only realised after we had recorded that segment. But Julie Robinson actually was my old headmistress at my friend's school. Yeah, I know. So I feel really embarrassed. I feel like I was very, not unfriendly, but I didn't.
Should have been friendlier.
I should have been friendlier. Mm. I didn't realise until after we had finished recording. So I'm sorry, Mrs. Robinson.
And finally, we're joined by the journalist Harriet Sargent, who's written in this week's magazine about an epidemic in shoplifting, and Xander Cloudsley, who is a shoplifting activist from Scotland. Harriet, in this week's magazine, you write about the dramatic rise in shoplifting. Can you tell us why it's risen so rapidly in the last few years?
Yes, I mean, shoplifting has, you know, globalisation has hit even shoplifting now, from just being quite, you know, something that happened locally with drug addicts, maybe with people who were just putting an extra packet of eggs in their shopping because they were really struggling. It's just exploded. And this is a lot to do with criminal gangs have, and often foreign criminal gangs have moved into shoplifting. And the stuff that's sort of hoovering off our shelves is going to fund firearms offences, drug dealing, human trafficking. And how it's working is that they are bringing over mainly women and children, because they don't attract the police attention, over to this country. And then they're moving them around the country, just sort of hitting different stores. And it's very difficult, because they're moving the whole time, to catch them. I mean, for example, there is one gang based in Glasgow, where you've got 154 shoplifters and 15 kids, and they've been shoplifting now all around the northwest, the northeast, since 2019. And the numbers, I mean, are quite extraordinary. I mean, convenience stores, it's risen. Attacks on convenience stores have risen from 1 million to 5.6 million in just 1 year.
Xander, can you tell us a little bit about the organisation that you're part of?
Yeah, hi, my name is Xander. I'm with This Is Rigged. Outside of that, I am a community food coordinator, and I run and conduct community meals, emergency food provision for people in my community who are experiencing quite sort of dire food insecurity. And outside of that, I do, you know, things with This Is Rigged, like spokesperson stuff like this. Yeah, I just wanted to maybe reflect on a little bit of what Harriet said, and I've read the version of the article that Harriet has written as to this point. It seems that even through, I find a very interesting read, but I think even through the lens of what you're writing, Harriet, I find it's what's being represented is clearly seems like an extremely small fraction of what the people who are actually shoplifting. And I can speak to my own experience working with people who are food insecure. The people who are making up the majority of people who are actually having to make these kind of very difficult decisions are people who are having to make the decision between either stealing or starving. That's a very simple choice. And I think everyone here, I would assume, and I think probably anyone, if they had to make the decision between shoplifting something from a supermarket and either not feeding themselves or their family, I think that's a very, very easy decision. And I think that's something that really shines through when I talk to people in my work. Just to take an example, actually, from what I read from what you'd written, Harry, if I could just quickly get a wee excerpt. I'm just going to read this, not a long bit, I'm just going to read it, but yeah, it says, "New figures released last month from the Co-op showed that its stores have suffered 300,000 incidents of shoplifting, abuse, violence and antisocial behaviour in 2023, an increase of 43% from the year before. I just want to say, first of all, to lump all four of these into the same category, I think is sort of quite disingenuous. Like, for example, if I was to say there were 50,000 incidents in my community of littering and assault, you would probably say, how many of those were littering and how many were assault? Like, to say that shoplifting and physical assault are on the same tier, I think is just, it's just very unfair to the people.
Well, to be fair to Harriet, right, that's the co-op choosing to put out those figures, aren't they? Can I just pick you up? You said earlier that what Harriet's describing here, organised criminals carrying out the shoplifting, you said it was a tiny fraction. Do you happen to have the figures? Do you know off the top of your head?
I'm afraid that's, because of my background, I don't work in the statistics of this kind of side of things. I can tell you about my experience of dealing with people who are living really at the very far end of, you know, how things are. I mean, I don't need to explain to you, I'm sure, how the cost of living crisis is rampant and how it's affecting everyone. You know, like, one in four Scots right now face direct food insecurity in the last year. That's a stat I can give you quite confidently based on Trussell Trust report from the middle of last year. But I can tell you, you know, the people I work with are people who regularly, as a matter of habit, skip meals all the time, go hungry themselves so they can feed their children, haven't put the heating on in years. This is who we're talking about. But anyway, just if I can just quickly follow up on a point I was making initially from the statistic that Harry had cited. It's so, yeah, 300,000 incidents of shoplifting, abuse, etc. And then cited that about 1,130 of those were violent, which accounts for less than 0.5% of that 300,000. So I think it's a bit disingenuous for us to base this whole discussion on what accounts for less than 0.5% of these incidents and not talk about the 99.5%+, which is actually people who are just making the very difficult decision to have to, you know, risk a criminal record and jeopardise their way of life just so that they can actually, you know, feed themselves. And I think that, you know, we should be asking why are these people stealing?
Yeah, I'd like to answer that. First of all, you know, I very much admire what you're doing, and I completely understand and sympathize with the people that you're representing and that you're speaking very eloquently for. But according to the shop owners themselves, the vast majority of these thefts is because of these sort of criminal gangs, these sort of international criminal gangs that have taken over. And Dame Sharon White, who is the head of John Lewis Partnership, she said, you know, it's moved on. In the last year, we've moved on from the people that you're talking about. You know, I'm just going to take an extra thing of eggs or whatever it is because I'm struggling. To organized gangs shoplifting to order on a way, she said, that I found profoundly shocking. So I do think that this great surge in, I mean, I'm actually arguing on your side. I mean, I think this great surge of shoplifting is not down to huge numbers of people, desperate people. It's actually down to these international gangs who aren't desperate at all. The figures that you picked up on, these include over, as you said, just over 1,000 physical assaults, but more than 36,000 incidents of antisocial behaviour and abuse. For instance, the violence against staff has risen from 450 incidents a day in 2019 to 850 last year. I mean, that's what, two a day? I mean, it's really shocking. I mean, as one shop worker said, you know, we were risking our lives to bring food to people during the pandemic. And now we're risking our lives again, working in a shop against people we've gotten no comeback against at all. I mean, as another one said, well, you know, why on earth should I be dying, putting my life on the line for a part-time job in Tesco's? But this is not a victimless crime, because shops are now losing £1 billion a year to this. And their answer is, well, we're just going to close the shop. We're going to close down the hours for these poor shop workers. So the shop workers are the first to suffer.
Can I just respond to that? I'd like to respond to that for me. So, yeah, I very much appreciate that raising the issue of, you know, worker well-being, and that's something I actually really wanted to touch on myself, so I appreciate that. I'd just like to quickly just cite a few very quick statistics that I think are very germane to what we're talking about here. So, last year, Sainsbury's, for an example, made in profit £330 million. So at the end, after paying every member of staff, meaning every single cost, every single overhead, there remained £330 million in the kitty. In that same year, Simon Roberts, the CEO, paid himself approximately, I think maybe just shy of £5 million, which was a £1.5 million raise on top of what he got paid before. And then I'm sure you're aware, like, I think maybe a week ago or not far off, 1,500 members of staff were sacked. So to me, that says, where did that money go? Where did that £330 million go? Clearly some of it went into Simon Roberts' pocket with him giving himself a raise on top of his already seven-figure salary. Why didn't it go towards, like, maintaining the well-being of the staff? Why didn't it go towards their job security? I think what we're talking about here is, you know, like, clearly the reason that shops get shut and that workers get sacked is not to do with shoplifting. It's to do with the supermarket corporates just sort of deciding that, you know, we're going to cut costs however we sort of see fit. Like, it's been framed as this thing that has to be done in order to keep themselves afloat. But that's clearly not the case because, like I say, they have made £330 million in profit. Tesco last year made £1 billion in profit.
You know, Britain has the lowest food prices of any country in Western Europe. I think as a percentage of people's take-home pay, what we spend on groceries is something like 9 or 10%. It is at a historic low. We are lucky to live in a country where food is so cheap. Obviously, we are currently going through a cost of living crisis. But what you're doing here, it sounds to me, is that you're sort of kind of defending shoplifting and saying, oh, well, look at all these profits the supermarkets are making. When you look at just how cheap food is historically, actually, I think we've been served quite well by capitalism and by supermarkets.
Has anyone here ever been to a food bank?
No.
Okay. Has anyone here had to go to a food bank?
No.
Okay. I can't emphasize enough, and I'm sure you don't mean to, but I can't emphasize enough how disrespectful this line of reasoning is to the people who are struggling as much as the people that I'm working with are. These people, like, they are the living evidence that we are not lucky. This is the way things are currently is absolutely disgraceful. This is the sixth richest nation in the world, and we have people routinely starving themselves because they can't afford to feed themselves. I mean, like, in terms of the amount of money people actually realistically get, I mean, I can't speak to your statistic about, you know, the relative prices of things globally, but, you know, I'm telling you, people can't afford their weekly shop. They can't afford their, like, daily shop. They can't afford to survive, let alone live. This is just not the case, and I don't know what I can say.
Well,
to
it
you
is.
To
I mean, those are the statistics. Those are the statistics. And actually, you know, I do not deny the idea that there are people struggling. Of course, there are. But I think what I'm trying to say is that our largest health crisis in this country is actually obesity. It isn't people starving. Food is comparatively a kind of very cheap good now compared to what it used to be, and we're lucky for that. And I know you think it's somehow kind of insulting, but you need to look at the bigger picture.
Well, I actually would strongly disagree. I think what I am doing is looking at the bigger picture. I maybe frame this in the context of our second demand, which is that the Scottish government fully fund the community food hub per every 500 households. And as we see it, that would be a place with no means testing, no referral needed. Anyone who's anyone can show up whenever, get 3 square meals a day that are perfectly nutritious and, you know, is relatively local to them. Ensuring people's right to food, and then, you know, people wouldn't have to be, you know, buying baby formula on the black market. We wouldn't have to people like having to make decisions like shoplifting. But anyway, to respond to what you're saying, yeah, if we can maybe talk about stealing for a second, you know, what, you know, stealing being, you know, taking something that doesn't rightfully belong to you from someone that it does rightfully belong to. And I think it's quite clear that, you know, given the rampant profiteering that's going on the parts of supermarket corporates, it's the people that are being stolen from. They've been, again, baby formula is 24% more expensive than it was 3 years ago, and it should only be 5% more expensive if you look at the rates of inflation. For example, a tin of baked beans gone up 41%, pint of milk 30-something percent. That is way, way, way past the rate of inflation, and it is simply due to supermarket corporates deciding that they're going to just take advantage of a good crisis and put an extra massive price markup on things that they know people depend on.
Thank you, Harriet, and thank you, Xander. Will, I think we've got to the end of this podcast. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, I always love the column by our agony aunt, Mary Killen, a.k.a. Dear Mary, and she has just such a wonderful piece of advice which she gives out in this week, and I couldn't really do it justice describing it. So luckily, we've asked Mary and GC from Abingdon to record the question and answer, and here it is.
Dear Mary, we are all exhibitionists in our family and love the old after-dinner games like charades, Who Am I? And Two Truths and a Lie. Usually our guests do too. But lately we find the younger members of our house parties seem much more inhibited than we were at their age and worried about making fools of themselves, when that is the whole point. How can we encourage them to join us in having a laugh and not take their images so seriously? From GC, Abingdon.
Try using the gateway game, blood pressure sweepstake, as a de-inhibitor. Buy a blood pressure monitor for £22 from the British Heart Foundation website, bhf.org.uk. Issue pens and paper and get everyone to make a guess at the blood pressure readings of everyone else playing the game. Engage the juniors by charging them with taking the real readings and noting them down. The prize will go to the person who has made the highest number of accurate guesses. Not only is this a brilliant icebreaker, it can also be a lifesaver.
And that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. We've had some extremely good feedback on the new format for the podcast, and it's always a joy to hear from listeners. So if you do want to get in touch and tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, please do send us an email at podcast@spectator.co.uk. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do pick up a copy of the magazine to read everything we've talked about in full and much more. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Gus Carter. And normal service will resume next week with Lara Prendergast, so don't bother complaining about me.